You're listening to Midoriha's first broadcast on the 8th of October 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midoriha's on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Markus Hippi. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, after an exciting weekend of election rallying, we bring you results and analysis from both Venezuela and Brazil. We'll also be heading to Berlin to speak to the Financial Times bureau chief Quentin Peel on the Eurozone's new permanent fund. Can it actually succeed in convincing the markets and creating stability? And we'll be joined by our culture editor, who will give us an overview of what we can expect over the next 2 days from our special programmes coming live from Frieze Art Fair.
There's Frieze Masters, which is a slightly different thing, which is where they're selling old gear. They're selling everything from like Greek antiquities to Rothko's. So that's kind of the big change. And then the day after, on Wednesday, we're going to be broadcasting live at the regular Contemporary Frieze Art Fair, which is just down the road. So these are two big tents that are erected in Regent's Park.
We'll also be asking why South Korean men are so much into makeup and pampering of their skin that the country is now the biggest market for men's skincare products.
You've got the K-pop imagery where you have young, very shiny, very smooth-skinned young men who have perfectly groomed eyebrows and perfectly clear complexions. And they're increasingly being used by cosmetics companies to front their products and also sort of really transmit the grooming message to men.
All that plus we get the latest from MIPCOM Television Entertainment Conference in Cannes and ask how you copyright a colour, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's catch up on the headlines with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has promised to deepen his socialist revolution after a comfortable election victory. The win could extend his leadership of the South American nation to 20 years. Tens of thousands of supporters thronged the streets around the presidential palace overnight after the former soldier beat opposition candidate Enrique Capriles by 9 percentage points. The new 6-year term will allow Mr. Chavez to consolidate his control over Venezuela's economy, possibly by extending a wave of nationalizations, and to continue his support for left-wing allies in Latin America and around the world. Eurozone finance ministers have been in Luxembourg to launch their 500 billion euro permanent bailout fund. The move puts in place a major defense against the debt crisis that now threatens Spain. The fund, called the European Stability Mechanism, will be used to lend to distressed Eurozone sovereigns in return for strict fiscal and structural reforms that aim to put economies that have lost investor trust back on track. And inspectors representing international lenders are in talks with the Greek government on reforms and austerity needed to unlock financial aid, but their full report is unlikely before the end of October. 9 people who put up bail for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, including 2 members of the British aristocracy and a Nobel Prize winner, were today ordered to pay £93,000 after Mr. Assange took refuge in Ecuador's embassy, effectively breaching his bail conditions. Westminster Magistrates Court ruled that the guarantors are liable for part of the bail fee they pledged. The Syrian government has agreed a deal which paves the way for the United Nations to expand its humanitarian operations in the country. UNICEF Director Anthony Lake said talks had led to agreements, meaning the organization could now work with a number of local groups that would allow them to address specific needs.
We have actually increased our staff in Syria. We're hoping to establish some local offices in various areas of Syria. And as I said, we've expanded the number of local partners that we are working with. And so I think we have an opportunity, if we can seize it, to save a lot of lives and improve the situation.
Scientists from Britain and Japan have shared a Nobel Prize for the discovery that adult cells can be transformed back into embryo-like stem cells that may one day regrow tissue in damaged brains, hearts or other organs. 79-year-old John Gurdon and Shinya Yamanaka discovered ways to create tissue that would act like embryonic cells without the need to harvest embryos. Dozens of protesters have rallied in New York to mark the 11th anniversary of the war in Afghanistan. In October 2001, the US-led coalition forces invaded the country to topple the Taliban government for harboring al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden after the September the 11th attacks on New York and Washington. One veteran, identified only as Michael, talked about the nightmare that haunted him during and after the wars he'd experienced.
Right now, a young soldier is trying to drink away the pain that will never leave. Right now, our brothers and sisters are in a war, not just with the enemy, but with themselves. Last year, more soldiers took their own lives than the enemy did. I'm 24 years old and a veteran of four combat tours, yet I'm the lucky one. A lot of my friends have nightmares that will haunt them for the rest of their natural born lives.
Michael became a deserter and is due to be tried by a military court. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you, James. It's 21:06 in Dubai, 18:06 in London and 10:06 a.m. in Los Angeles. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Where you London? This is Monocle 24.
Ut London, my Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, desde Londres.
Holanda.
London kara.
London으로부터.
From London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House, live from Studio One in London. This year has been a busy time for elections all over the world, from revolutionary political shifts in the Middle East to economic woes driving voters to polls across Europe. There's also the face-off between Obama and Romney. This weekend, however, focused its attentions on Venezuela and Brazil. Following our coverage last week, today we are here to give you an election roundup from the weekend. In a moment, we'll be speaking to Monocle's Caracas correspondent Sarah Granger. But firstly, I am joined in the studio by Monocle's resident Brazilian Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Hello.
Hello, Marcus.
Well, the mayoral election took place in as many as 5,565 cities around Brazil. Who were the winners?
Well, that's a very difficult question, actually, because none of the parties they can claim victory this year. It was a very divided election. But if I have to tell you, there's a new leftist force in Brazil. There's a new party called PSB, which is the Brazilian Socialist Party. And they did very well. They won the mayoralty in Belo Horizonte and Recife, which is two very important capitals. And actually, I think one, the leader of this party might be a strong contender for the presidential elections in 2014.
How would you describe, how does this PSB party differ from other parties that have already been earlier seen in Brazil?
Well, I think they have this leftist speech, but and some people, they're getting tired a little bit of the Workers' Party, which is the party of President Dilma. And they're kind of just a renewal of the left, I would say. And I think Dilma should be worried, because they did very well this year.
So those were the winners, but which parties then did not do so well? Who were the losers?
Well, the one that comes to my mind is DEM, which is our conservative party. And they did very bad, actually. They just elected 271 mayors. And just as a comparison, I would say like around 10 years ago, they elected more than 1,000. So I think they're definitely a waning party. I'm not even sure if the next elections they will still be there.
What happened to them?
Well, first of all, when Brazil got the democracy back in 88, they didn't have a good image because they were the party who supported the military dictatorship. But in 94, they were part of the coalition with President Fernando Henrique Cardoso. But when the Workers' Party got into power, they were basically, I mean, of course, a few cities in the northeast here and there, but they are a waning party in Brazil for sure.
Well, let's talk about surprises then. I bet there has been some of them seen in Brazil during this weekend as well. What comes into your mind first?
Well, the first thing was São Paulo, which, it was expected that we would go for the second round, because in Brazil, cities that have more than 200,000 inhabitants go for the second round of the elections if they don't get the majority. But in São Paulo, the lead candidate, Celso Russomanno, he was the leader of the polls. But actually, the second round is going to be with two candidates, but not with Russomanno. because he dropped sharply in the last few days because the other two candidates, they attacked him heavily. And that's the biggest surprise. I was not expecting that.
Can there be? Can you specify one single moment when things would have gone wrong for him, or what happened?
Well, he had strong connections to the evangelical churches, and even though the evangelical churches they do get a lot of votes in Brazil, there's a lot of people who are a bit skeptical about that as well. So, So and he was from a minority party, so he didn't have much time on TV at our electoral campaign. So, yeah, he didn't prove as strong as the polls were saying that he was going to be.
The two biggest cities in Brazil, Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro, was there some kind of difference between the voting results, or did people vote the same way in both the cities?
Definitely not. There's a very big difference. And I wanted to point you out how the middle classes and the rich vote in two cities are very different. In Rio, The richest neighborhoods like Ipanema, Leblon, they tend to vote for the far left, for the Green Party candidate, so quite progressive and liberal. But in São Paulo, in the richest neighborhoods or the middle classes one, they always tend to vote conservative and center-right. And I think it's fascinating because it's the same group of people, but they vote completely different. I think that's very fascinating.
Can you come up with some reasons for that?
I don't know, maybe it's the liberals' joy de vivre attitude of the Cariocas, and I don't know, it's a bit embarrassing. I would like São Paulo to be a little bit more like Rio when it comes to voting, in a way.
Well, one more thing about the elections, there will now also be a record number of female mayors.
Exactly. I have to say, I mean, it is a record number, but I mean, we still need to improve quite a lot. I mean, come on, we have a female president, we need more. At the moment, yesterday elections, we had 621 cities governed by women, which is about 12% of the total. I mean, it's not a lot, but if you compare in 96, only 3% were women. I mean, that's quite an improvement, no?
So a few years ahead, there will be a significant amount of women.
I hope so.
In those jobs. Thank you very much. That was Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Monocle's researcher there. And in Venezuela, President Hugo Chavez has been celebrating his re-election after getting 54% of the votes. And joining us on the line from Caracas is Sarah Granger. Welcome and thanks for joining Midori House. What have been the reactions to these election results there?
Well, I think it very much depends which side of the political divide you feel you belong to. Obviously, for supporters of Mr. Chavez, it was an instant party when the results were announced. We had street parties springing up across Caracas, people playing music, dancing in the street, honking their car horns, really jubilant and possibly a little bit relieved that Mr. Chavez had won, because this had been, you know, a bit of a test of his presidency and his leadership. So those supporters of Mr. Capriles, many of whom had really believed that this could be the opposition's chance to seize power at the ballot box, I mean, really despondency, depression, we saw tears last night from many of his supporters. He himself has remained relatively upbeat, thanked everybody for their support, and said that he is going to continue his political career, and I assume that means to try to continue as some kind of leader, if you like, of the opposition.
Can you say anything about what re-electing Chavez can mean for Venezuela?
Well, I think it's interesting to note that he was re-elected by a fairly comfortable margin, by a 10-point margin, but in comparison to how he performed in previous elections, that was actually quite a tight race. Back in 2006, he won basically by about 30 percentage points. So he himself, in his acceptance speech last night, said, you know, I'm going to be a better president. And I think maybe, you know, some awareness from the government that they've lost a lot of ground to the opposition, even though they are still ahead. So whilst during campaigning, Mr. Chavez had talked about deepening his socialist revolution, I think the speech from last night really showed that, you know, he's aware that he might have to sit up and take notice of some of the criticism that there's been around his presidency and around the way the government runs things. And I'm thinking specifically of issues like insecurity, which is a huge topic, lots of crime, one of the highest murder rates in the world here in Venezuela, and also the economy, the fact that it's hugely oil dependent, not diversified at all, and very much at the mercy of inflation. We have one of the highest inflation rates in the world here in Venezuela.
Sarah, where is the opposition going to go from here now?
Well, in the sort of medium term, we're looking at future elections, local elections for state governors and for mayors in December. So that's kind of the next thing that they need to look forward to. They need to try and keep their coalition of parties together to stand in those elections. That's their next chance to really, you know, take the competition to the Socialist Party that really still dominates here. Beyond those elections, I think a big question for them is whether Enrique Capriles, the presidential candidate, can maintain his profile at the head of the party, as it were, the head of the union, if you like, and to sort of keep up a unified message. Because, of course, one of the issues that people are thinking about is President Chavez's health. He had that health issue with cancer over the last year or so, and the terms of office here are for 6 years. So, you know, he's won a fresh six-year term that starts in January, but lots of people really wondering, you know, can he serve the whole six-year term? What if his health doesn't hold up? And if that were to be the case, then obviously the opposition would be in a stronger position if they'd managed to keep their coalition together and if they still had a recognizable figurehead, somebody like Mr. Capriles, who could go up against, a different representative of the Socialist Party should Mr. Chavez have to step aside.
Can you see this election result having international repercussions?
I mean, I don't know about repercussions in the sense that nothing here has changed. You know, we have the same government in power and there's going to be continuity in that sense. I think, you know, a sigh of relief on behalf of Cuba, because they rely heavily on subsidized oil from Venezuela and really have very close relationships with Mr. Chavez and really probably would have been in quite big trouble if Mr. Chavez hadn't got back into power. In terms of other countries, Mr. Chavez has had something of a rapprochement with Colombia, and it seems to be very much coordinating with them, trying to cooperate with them on the peace talks that we hope are going to come up with the FARC rebels and the Colombian government. And in the United States, you know, he said that he perhaps not supports President Obama, but if Obama were to be reelected in the U.S. in November, that he could have, you know, something of a working relationship with President Obama. So in that sense, you know, it's much the same as we've already seen, more of the same from Mr. Chavez. But in a sense, you know, that gives continuity and perhaps that's not such a bad thing for Venezuela at this point.
Thank you. That was Monocle's Sarah Grange live from Caracas. You are listening to Midori House. It's 17 minutes past the top of the hour, and coming up next we will discuss the Eurozone's new permanent fund. So stay with us.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily, with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture and business. Hear from experts, authors and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
Subscribe to Monocle and you'll receive 10 hefty issues and our two seasonal newspapers, delivered anywhere in the world. You'll also receive our special edition canvas tote bag and sometimes even invitations to special events in our key markets. With a variety of subscription options, Monocle is available monthly from £45, and you can also order our special gift package for friends and clients who want to keep an eye on the world. Subscribe today at monocle.com or pop into our shops in Tokyo, Hong Kong, London and New York.
You're listening to Midori House. The Eurozone's new permanent fund to bail out struggling economies and banks has been formally launched at a meeting of finance ministers in Luxembourg, despite the launch of European Stability Mechanism, referred to as the bazooka. There is still disagreement over how the fund will work and how effective it will be in raising money. To spread light on what this new tool could mean for the Eurozone, I am now joined on the phone by Financial Times Berlin Bureau Chief Quentin Peel. Hello. Quentin, in brief, why should we believe that European Stability Mechanism can actually relieve the euro crisis and help the euro countries in financial trouble?
Well, I think that the key to this is actually the deal that's been done with the European Central Bank. because the two together really start to look like something quite impressive. The euro, the European Stability Mechanism, this ESM that's just been set up with 500 billion euros of funds that it can draw on, is actually a bit slow moving. It takes time to raise money. It's going to negotiate difficult programs with anybody who wants to come for money. And on its own, I think, is not quite as impressive as the markets would like to see. But now that the central bank has come in and said, look, if you've done a deal with the European Stability Mechanism, we'll then come in and buy up government bonds in the secondary market and our funds are unlimited, the two together actually become quite an impressive firewall to stop the crisis.
What are the things that there is still disagreement over?
Well, the precise nature of the sort of conditionality that might be imposed. I mean, we're expecting, most people are now expecting, that the first country that will turn to the ESM is going to be Spain. Well, for a start, there's disagreement about whether they really will have to do it or not. The Spanish government seem to say one day that they will and the next day that they won't. The German government, Wolfgang Schäuble, the finance minister, today was saying, I don't think the Spanish need it. But the truth is, we expect they will, and everything will come down to how tough the conditionality is that's imposed on them. And that all remains open to be negotiated program by program.
Where does the money for this permanent fund then come from?
From all the member states of the Eurozone. They've contributed both paid-up capital and capital that's on call. And that makes it a much more substantial, if you like, fund than the temporary fund that we've been running with up to now, the European Financial Stability Facility, which had 440 billion, but it was all based on financial guarantees. Nobody put in paid-up capital. So the difference now is this fund has paid-up capital. It therefore is more impressive to the markets. It'll be easier to raise money against that paid-up capital, and it can move more quickly.
Well, ESM should be able to use up to 500 billion euros. Is that enough?
Well, it's as long as a piece of string, really. I mean, it's very difficult to say what is enough. I think everybody wanted something that would so impress the markets. They were talking about $1 billion and so on. All these things, they've come up with a series of schemes whereby they can leverage these funds and maybe bring in outside investors like some of the BRIC countries like China, India, Brazil, who might actually get involved in bond buying schemes to bolster the fund. But you know, I think really what this is all about is trying to set up a backstop for the Eurozone that impresses financial investors in the markets enough so that it never has to be used. That would be everybody's ideal, that it's a fund that's there for emergencies but only for the rainy day that never comes.
Quentin, can you say anything about the initial reaction yet?
Well, I think it's been so long in coming, this. I mean, it's been more than a year now that this has been being put into effect. It's been regarded most suspiciously, really, where I am here in Germany, that many people in Germany feel that this is the beginning of what they call a transfer union, where essentially Germany is the major funder, the major treasury for the whole of the rest of the Eurozone, and it will just drain Germany of funds. Well, the German Constitutional Court's given it the green light, the Parliament's given it the green light, and now it's up and running. It could be in the future a European Monetary Fund, a really substantial fund like the International Monetary Fund, but just for Europe. And that would be the beginning of the fiscal union, which I think people do see down the road as being a much closer, more integrated Eurozone at the heart of the European Union.
Thank you very much. That was the Financial Times Bureau Chief in Berlin, Quentin Peel. You are listening to Midori House. During the two following days, Midori House programme, yes, the one you're listening to right now, will be broadcast live from Freeze Art Fair. And I am now joined by the host of these two shows, Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound.
Hi, Marcus. How's
Hello.
It going?
Not bad at all. How are yourself?
I'm all right. I'm looking forward to tomorrow. We've bated breath.
What is coming up?
Well, so we took our outside broadcast equipment to the Olympics. As you remember, we enjoyed sitting around a table together doing those shows. We're taking it on the road, just up the road to Regent's Park, London's leafy autumnal Regent's Park at the moment, for Freeze, the annual art fair, one of the sort of four big ones across the world. And this year it's kind of all changed. So there's Freeze Masters, which is a slightly different thing, which is where they're selling old gear. They're selling everything from like Greek antiquities to Rothko's. So that's kind of the big change. And then the day after, on Wednesday, we're going to be broadcasting live at the regular Contemporary Freeze Art Fair, which is just down the road. So these are two big tents that are erected in Regent's Park.
So basically two events at the same time taking place. Do you think it's going to work? Do you think it's going to be even a bigger success than what's been seen in London during the previous years?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, the question we always ask when Freeze rolls around every year, when Art Basel rolls around in the summer, is, well, when's the bubble going to burst? You know, like, do people still have tens of thousands of pounds and millions of pounds to spend on paintings, you know? And do people really still have that many gaps over their mantelpieces to fill?
And what is your opinion when it comes to these questions?
I think it will. I think the Freeze magic is kind of, I think Matthew Slotover and Amanda Sharp, the two co-founders of Freeze, the magazine, and then the art fair, they sprinkle their very subtle, very cool art world sort of dust over, they've spread it over the contemporary art world, and I think that people will be intrigued and hopefully, well, we'll see if they sort of vote with their wallets as well as their feet, but I'm sure there'll be a lot of footfall at both those fairs. And then Freeze Masters is a big gamble. I expect they're kind of nervous about whether it'll go well or not. So we'll be broadcasting live and we'll be speaking to the founders and from various gallerists and artists at the fair as well tomorrow.
Oh, that sounds...
Not artists at the Freeze. We're not going to try and sort of get Marcel Duchamp back from the grave or Picasso.
Why not?
But we'll be speaking to, yeah, over the next 2 days on those live shows, we'll be speaking to a sort of wild cavalcade. It's going to be a magical mystery tour, Marcus.
Awesome. This all takes place in less than 24 hours. That was Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound. And indeed, be sure to tune in tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. Headlines are approaching, but first here is Danielle Merriweather with Impossible. That was Danielle Merriweather with Impossible. In the next half hour of the programme, we'll discover why men's skincare is flying off the shelves in South Korea, and we'll be bringing you the latest from MIPCOM conference in Cannes. But first, here is James Luckhurst with the news headlines.
The Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has promised to deepen his socialist revolution after a comfortable election victory. The win could extend his leadership of the South American nation to 20 years. Tens of thousands of supporters thronged the streets around the presidential palace overnight after the former soldier beat opposition candidate Henrique Capriles by 9 percentage points. Eurozone finance ministers have been in Luxembourg to launch their €500 billion permanent bailout fund. The move puts in place a major defence against the debt crisis that now threatens Spain. Inspectors representing international lenders are also in talks with the Greek government on reforms and austerity needed to unlock financial aid. Their full report is unlikely before the end of October. 9 people who put up bail for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, including 2 members of the British aristocracy and a Nobel Prize winner, have today been ordered to pay £93,000 after Mr. Assange took refuge in Ecuador's embassy, effectively breaching his bail conditions. The Syrian government has agreed a deal which paves the way for the United Nations to expand its humanitarian operations in the country. UNICEF Director Anthony Lake said talks had led to agreements, meaning the organisation could now work with a number of local groups that will allow them to address specific needs. And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24, coming to you live from London. Well, it seems that South Korean men have gone through a transformation from macho to metrosexual skin pampering. Despite having not more than 19 million men, South Korea is reportedly the world's largest market for men's skincare products. Nearly $500 million got spent there on men's skincare last year. But who are the users of these products? To tell us more, I'm now joined on the line by Vivian Rudd, Director of Insight Beauty and Personal Care at Mintel Group. Hello, and thank you for joining Midori House. Could you first answer this question? Who exactly are these men in South Korea who are buying all these products?
Well, the men vary a great deal in age, from the youngest teenagers right through to older men who wouldn't necessarily buy such products in other countries. But mainly the market is concentrated on men in their early 20s to late 30s who are either in full-time employment or who are doing their military service.
What kind of products are being sold to these men?
Well, I think people who aren't familiar with the South Korean market might be quite surprised. Rather than just concentrating on traditional sort of refreshing and energizing messages that we see in the West, in South Korea, it's all about total grooming. So it's about having clear skin, anti-aging, firming claims, a lot of whitening claims. And then there's a really interesting little niche coming through called camouflage makeup, which is very particular to South Korea.
And who are the ones who want to apply camouflage makeup?
Well, surprisingly, it's men who are actually in the military. So these camouflage makeup palettes have got camouflage patterning on the lids and then camouflage colours like green, black and beige inside. And they're really for helping men to look their best, even on the battlefield, as it were, but also to prepare them for when they're re-entering civilian life.
I mean, that makes me wonder, what is behind all this? This change has happened relatively rapidly anyway. It wasn't like that in South Korea 20 years ago or not even 10 years ago. For example, the men in military, what do they want to achieve by, for example, wearing this camouflage makeup?
What you have in South Korea is an extremely educated male population where 80% of them are going on to university. When they graduate, they're chasing a shrinking number of jobs from high chip companies, and they're not willing to consider jobs lower down in SMEs, for example. So it's a really fierce employment climate, and men who are in the military are very aware of this, and they want to look their best for when they're re-entering civilian life. And men who are going for jobs or men who are trying to keep hold of their jobs are also feeling the same pressures. So these products really feed into that.
Do you know if there is actual evidence that this would indeed work, that when you wear makeup as a man you can get a job more easily?
It certainly seems that they believe that it works, and that's why they're buying them.
How much all this does have to do with the flawless images of South Korean popular culture as well, and fashion?
I think it has a lot to do with them, and it's coming from two directions. First of all, you've got the K-pop imagery, where you have young, very shiny, very smooth-skinned young men who have perfectly groomed eyebrows and perfectly clear complexions. And they're increasingly being used by cosmetics companies to front their products and also sort of really transmit the grooming message to men. And then at the same time, you're getting a more mature image of masculinity coming through. So, for example, Procter & Gamble chose South Korea as the first launch pad for its SK-II men's products. And this is fronted by a 35-year-old film director and actor who has a much more subdued but nonetheless extremely handsome appearance.
Do you think South Korea indeed works as some kind of a testing place for men's skincare and cosmetic products, considering that they are so keen to use them?
Yeah, I think you're right. As you imply, it's a relatively soft place for them to launch because it has got the most receptive audience. But the interesting thing is that South Korea is increasingly being positioned as a skincare authority throughout the world. So maybe these companies are hoping that by gaining a really willing audience in South Korea, this audience will spread the word elsewhere. And then consumers in other countries will buy in. I mean, already they've taken these SK-II products into China and Japan. And from there, I believe the next country to get the launch will be the US. So we'll just have to watch and see.
Do you think this would work? Do you think you can? Do you think these skincare products and fashion, all this could actually also spread to the West?
I think it's a difficult one. There have been occasions in the past where other brands have tried to launch products. I'm thinking of Guyliner, for example, and Yves Saint Laurent when it did the male version of Touche Éclat, and they weren't massive successes, to say the least. So there is a much more resistant audience in the West. And I think the brands that have the products in South Korea and Asia will have to overcome this by adjusting their messaging, subtly or not so subtly, to appeal to men who may otherwise be off-put by this sort of feminization.
That was Vivienne Rudd, Director of Insight Beauty and Personal Care at the Mintel Group. Thank you very much. You are listening to Midori House. And now the boys partially responsible for the skincare boom. This is South Korea's 2PM with I'll Be Back.
I'll be back. 넌 다시 나를 찾을 거야. 그때 다시 내가 올 거야. 그 누구도 너를 나보다 사랑할 순 없기에.
That was 2PM and I'll be back. It's 18 minutes to the top of the hour. And next we'll be asking, how do you copyright a colour? Stay with us.
The Entrepreneurs is a show about inspiring startups, innovative business models and smart CEOs. It's about good ideas and the people with the business acumen to make them into the brands of tomorrow.
Character, your vision, your courage, all these are necessary to become a leader.
On the latest episode, we meet a business duo that established a knitwear brand using Mongolian cashmere. We drop in on the World Retail Congress, and we hear from a man who reinvented the figure of the chic, bespectacled, clever American.
We decided that we would put a search for and try to buy vintage frames or original frames from doctors across America that maybe have old stock.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
You're listening to Midori House. Can you copyright a colour? It sure seems like that now. The chocolate giant Cadbury has won a legal battle to prevent its competitors from using its signature purple colour on their wrappers. Cadbury has been battling its Swiss rival Nestlé for the last 4 years over the use of its own signature purple. And in the beginning of this month, Britain's High Court ruled that Pantone 2685 purple is distinctive of Cadbury for milk chocolate. To tell us more about how companies use colours to brand themselves, I'm joined in the studio by Simon Black, branding expert from Design Bridge, and Claire Aitken, writer at Monocle's sister company Wing Creative. Welcome to Midori House Studio One.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can you give other examples of colours that have been copyrighted?
There are some really kind of key luxury brands that have obviously copyrighted colours. I mean, you think of Hermes and you think of orange, Harrods with the green, Tiffany with the blue, Christian Louboutin with the red. So I don't think it's necessarily a new thing, but I think this is kind of, it's quite interesting that it's now starting to stray more into the mainstream rather than just premium brands that are really synonymous with colour.
Can you come up with other examples of colours that are important for companies?
Yeah, I mean, you remind me of an interesting example of the orange there. What about Verve, another fabulous brand, which is all at Verve Clicquot, which is all about the orange. But then on the other hand, we take that same colour and think of perhaps EasyJet. Even on the ground, looking into the sky and it's 25,000 feet away, you can just about spot those little orange flecks on the aircraft. And you know straight away it's EasyJet. So colour's hugely important for brands and brand owners to make sure it's a signifier of what they're about and distinctive enough to separate them from their competitors.
Simon, you also brought something with you to the studio.
Oh, a few props always help a story, don't they? So I brought these little 3x3-inch post-it notes.
I have seen those.
Yes, we've all seen them. And but there's a particular colour to this, and it's called Canary Yellow. And that's been trademarked by the 3M company many years ago. And of course, its patent has kind of dropped off over the last decade or so, I believe, in the United States at least. And so there are other companies who can now use similar assets and equities. But still, the trademark of the Canary Yellow is very much part of the 3M. And I was lucky enough to be a volunteer games maker during the recent London 2012 Olympics. And I was blessed with wearing these fabulous royal purple and red colours. And of course, the purple of Cadbury, who were the principal sponsors of the games makers, is part of the story, I believe, behind why this is a part of a purple outfit. So I'm sure I'm not supposed to be a chocolate bar, nor a particularly milk chocolate bar at that. But what I would say is that, of course, by association, they're building their brand and building their story. Arguably, of course, not even the right colour. But you know, that's one of the problems of operating in multi-channel environments. Very difficult to replace or to replicate Pantones across different channels and media.
Do you think that it would actually be on someone's interest to try to start using the same colours? Do you think the consumers would actually, maybe not even without realising, go and buy other products? Say if someone else got to use that same purple colour Cadbury's been using, do you think consumers would actually start buying another brand of chocolate?
I think potentially. I suppose the question is whether or not people would deliberately choose another chocolate that used the same kind of branding or had a similar identity, or whether it would be mistakenly picked up instead of its competitor. But in terms of what sort of Nestlé have done to themselves, I think it's very, very interesting, because I think it's actually much more of a cynical ploy on Nestlé's part, the fact that they had tried to encroach upon Cadbury's brand territory by using this purple instead of focusing on really building their own brand.
What kind of evidence, when you go to court, for example, and you try to prove that this one specific colour is very important for you as a company, what kind of evidence do you have to offer so that they actually like agree with you that it is true, this colour indeed belongs to you?
Well, different countries have slightly different systems. In our country here in the UK, we've got a patent office and a trademark registry. And when you're registering or asking for a registration in a certain class of products or services, and that's really important to remember, that orange for EasyJet is perhaps a similar or same orange as to one of the famous brands we mentioned before, but it's in a completely different class of products and services. And so there isn't necessarily a conflict there. So the kind of evidence one needs to go with is evidence of continued usage over a period of time, evidence of brand building, and evidence of consumers recognising what your colour means in that particular category of services and products. So you evidence that, you bring those kinds of that kind of documentation and evidence with you, and hopefully you move forward towards a successful registration in a particular class.
So what does that actually lead into? You know, if the legislation is different around the world, is it possible that actually somewhere there are colour clashes and somewhere it is illegal to use the same colours?
Yeah, that sort of thing does happen, and there are international ways of attempting to resolve that, because there are similarities in legislation, especially across groupings of countries like the European Union, for example. But I think what's, you know, even more interesting perhaps are where two companies may start off in very different products and services, but because of the nature of brand extensions, slowly but surely they might find themselves in conflict with another company which has a similar principal colour. And that's when things can become awkward, and it's all about evidence at that moment.
Well, to get back to the power of colour, when there are new products that are being launched, products that use specific colours, how conscious is the decision to use one specific colour?
Oh, it's extremely conscious. I mean, from any sort of branding point of view, colour is an absolutely integral brand asset. It often doesn't hinge quite so strongly on one colour as perhaps Cadbury's does, but any branding agency worth its salt will spend an awful lot of time getting the colour palette exactly right. Something that's kind of really rooted in the brand's essence, and also something that's unique and will distinguish it from other brands, perhaps in the same space.
How long time does it take to get to the stage when you can actually get to, like, where, for example, Cadbury is at the moment, that everyone actually knows where the colour is from and who uses the colour?
Ah, look, Cadbury's is an amazing company with an amazing heritage of well over 100 years. And the story of their purple, whether it's about the symbolism of the Roman Empire moving into royal robes and colours, you know, around the world, and therefore it being a premium association in our minds, you know, semiotically and through symbolism, I don't know. But at some point over those 100 years, we've become become enormously instinctive about that natural association. You take a wrapper off a bar of chocolate, you see that purple foil underneath, and you don't need to be asked. You just know where it is and what it is. And that's part of, it becomes part of dominant accepted culture.
What about smells and smells and sounds?
We were just talking about this actually, just off air. You can obviously trademark an awful lot of things. Color is one of them. You know, obviously logos and icons, very important as well. But you can also obviously trademark things like shapes, like Coca-Cola's iconic bottle, and then smells and sounds. So we were just talking about various sounds that are really kind of unique to a particular brand. And I think one that probably everyone's very familiar with from all walks of life is the MGM lion that roars at the beginning of the. Of the sort of movie credits at the beginning. And I think you've got another more recent example than that. That's great.
Yes, our own colleagues in our trademark consultancy have been working recently to help register Alexander the Meerkat's squeak that we all hear on the advertising. So in the products and services associated with insurance, nobody else can now begin to use that squeak, else we'll know it's an attempt to confuse the public.
I think there's something really interesting, though, in the difference between how you trademark something like a sound and what's just happened with Cadbury's, because it's very much a difference between creating a new brand asset and protecting what's already yours. So in the Cadbury's case, what was really key was proving that the purple was already synonymous in the mind of the consumer with the brand. It wasn't kind of a new brand starting up saying, we're choosing this colour and none of you can use it for your own products. So I think there's sort of two different things at play. One's creating a new brand asset and one's being very careful to, you know, to trademark and protect your own.
Thank you very much for this. Simon Black, branding expert from Design Bridge, and Claire Aitken, writer at Monocle's sister company, Wing Creative. It's 7 minutes to the top of the hour. You are listening to Midori House.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 har vært, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ja Jorgensa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojalavet. Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
After I met on Monocle 24.
The hat at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. MIPCOM, an annual conference on the television entertainment markets, is currently alive and swinging in Cannes. And though it may seem like all eyes are on iPads, iPhones or computer screens, television audiences are still growing and the medium is as strong as ever. Joining me live from Cannes is Ed Waller, editorial director of C21 Media, hopefully at this point in the evening with a glass of something bubbly in hand. Ed, welcome. What is the atmosphere like at this year's conference?
Well, it's busier than has been over the past few years, what with the recession and so forth. But I think the mood is optimistic. People are buying. I mean, there's 12,000 buyers and sellers here, all buying and selling TV shows. The market was woke this morning to the news that YouTube had unveiled its European Channels initiative, and that excited the market quite a lot because. What it essentially means is that if you're a producer or a distributor of programming, you don't have to wait until your show goes up to the TV channel, the regular TV channel. You can launch your own channel through YouTube, and a lot of companies are doing that.
whether it's from big distributors like BBC Worldwide or little production companies in local in, here in France. So it allows those producers to have a direct relationship with their viewers. They can put all their back catalogue on that channel. They can produce original web video for that channel, and it allows them a whole new revenue stream, which avoids all the traditional gatekeepers, which are the old school TV channels. So that was an interesting development.
Another
interesting thing is that there's been a lot about web content as well. And it seems that the big broadcasters are scouring the web now for original content, original ideas, whether it's something that's produced professionally or even an amateur guy in his top bedroom putting out some kind of video blog. They're picking up this stuff and turning it into TV shows. So it's kind of interesting that they're kind of outsourcing the whole development process to the web now, a lot of channels, particularly kids' channels. And you can look at anything from Angry Birds to The Annoying Orange or whatever. They've all got literally sort of billions of views and downloads, and if they're an asset, you know, the global brands. And the TV channels are desperate to tap into that and turn those brands into TV shows that they can own and monetize. So it's interesting that the traditional TV development process is being sort of outsourced to the web.
Well, the search for television formats continues as well, and I've heard that Israel, Japan and Scandinavia are the hot sources.
Yeah, in terms of one of the big trends over the last few years has been the international market for TV formats, because demand for local production, local programming with local people in it around the world. You know, if you're French, you want to see shows with French people in. If you're German, you want to see shows with German people in. So this has driven this demand for remake rights. And traditionally, it's been the UK and Holland that have cornered this market. And you can think of any number of game shows, reality shows, dating shows, talent shows that have originated from those two countries that have dominated the market over the last decade, really. You know, X Factor, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, Big Brother. But now what's happening is that people are understanding the question and coming back with their own formats around the world. And one of the big trends this time around is Japan and Israel are emerging as very competent developers of their own formats, which they can then export back into the countries that they used to buy formats from. So that's an interesting one. And Scandinavia has been on that trend for a number of years now.
We could speak so much more about this, but I'm afraid we have to let it finish it there. Thank you very much. That was Ed Waller, editorial director of C21 Media, live from Cannes. That's indeed all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer Dawn Trump, our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager Sam Impi. Up next after the news is this week's episode of Culture Show. Today they speak with one of Robert Bowne's heroes, Jonathan Mead, and find out how to frame art. And in 3 hours, it's time for today's edition of Monocle Daily. And Robert Bowne will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow and Wednesday for special coverage of Freeze. Thank you for listening and goodbye.